Appreciated that devotional meditation, blood covenant, and the similarities from the Old Testament blood covenant to the New Testament, the covenant of the New Testament. For a message this morning, a starting point this morning, I invite you to turn with me to Luke chapter 23. There's a number of verses we're going to be looking at here. We'd like to, this being a communion service, we'd like to think about the cross, and I'd like to look at some contrasts at the cross, some contrasts, things that maybe what people thought were happening, how vastly different it was, or things that appeared on the surface to man, what God knew about the situation, so vastly different. I thought about contrasts this morning driving into the city. Last Sunday, I spoke at Sterling Harbor, Alaska, and in the little congregation there, they have this story of sitting in church Sunday morning, and a moose walked out of the woods and came over to the church and looked in the window. They stopped their service to enjoy the moose looking in the window. I don't suppose a moose will look in the window this morning. Last Sunday morning, it was snowing, beautiful white snow on the pine trees. In a state where their population is one, a little over one per square mile in the state of Alaska. And I think here in New York City, it's 27,000 per square mile. So things that are vastly different. Here in the cross, the story of the cross, the subject of Calvary, the place where Jesus was crucified, there's some vast contrast, some things that are so different. You ever have a situation in your life where you were really hurting, something happened, and maybe you lost a loved one close to you, and your heart was bleeding from that, and you're working through that, and a friend of yours calls you, and they have a little hurt, a wee little hurt compared to what you have. And they're all stressed out about this little hurt, and as you talk to them, in your own mind, you're saying, if they only knew, if they only knew what I'm going through. Like, so they think, this is such a big deal, and over here I'm carrying a load that's way, way beyond that. Many times in those situations, we scarcely can even talk about it. Often we try to minister to someone with our little itty-bitty need while we're carrying a heavy load ourselves. Contrast. And in this story of Calvary, there's some of those events where God from heaven, Jesus from the cross, I believe could look and say, they have no clue. They have no clue what's going on here. So the first one I'd like to think about, each of these points start with the word Calvary, the place where Jesus was crucified. But the first one is this: Calvary, the place of ultimate love, yet the place of judgment and death. That's the contrast. Ultimate love, the greatest love ever shown to man, on Calvary, but it was a place of judgment and death. Here in Luke chapter 23, let's start reading with verse 33. And when they were come to the place which is called Calvary, there they crucified him and the malefactors, one on the right hand and the other on the left. Now we read that verse fairly easily. There they crucified him. I've never seen a crucifixion. This is a capital punishment event. This is the Roman soldiers killing a man, killing three men for punishment. And it was a gruesome event. You know, in our world today, there's a lot of talk about capital punishment being as painless as possible, quickly done. But in the Romans' minds, crucifixion was the most painful thing they could think of and the slowest death possible. That's the death that Jesus died. Excruciating pain for hours hanging on the cross. That's what they look for when they look for capital punishment. And here it simply says there they crucified him. We're talking about a place of ultimate love, yet a place of judgment and death. But listen to verse 34. Then said Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they parted his raiment and cast lots. Do you think there was ever a human before who came to a crucifixion, who came to that excruciating pain, who came to that moment of death? Do you think that the Roman soldiers were used to men as the nails were being driven through their hand, used to men looking at them and saying, Father, bless them, forgive them. Don't lay this sin to their charge. Forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. You see, here's a place where as Jesus was being nailed to the cross, he understood what was going on. He could say, they don't have a clue. They don't have a clue what's going on. They don't have a clue what they're doing with this. And as the hatred of the Jews was poured out there, as the Roman soldiers carried out this event of punishment and death was an event of love. Where Jesus, where God so loved, we know that verse in John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Contrast that to their hatred. Here this day on the cross, hatred was being carried out against the one who loved more than anyone ever loved. That's the contrast. That's the first contrast. Place of ultimate love, yet the place of judgment and death. If you go down to verse 23, it says, well, let's see, back up to verse 23. And they were instant with loud voices, requiring that he might be crucified. And the voices of them and the chief priests prevailed. Verse 23, the voices of mad humanity prevailed. The voice of Jesus was not heard. The humanity got their wish. Now, it was God's design and it was God's plan. We'll see that a little later. But it says in verse 24, Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they required. It looks like a requirement of Jews and Romans working together that this must be carried out. And actually, they didn't have a clue, but it was the plan of God. It was the plan of God. You contrast this idea here in verse 23 that the voices of them prevailed. Their word prevailed. Contrast that with Jesus' prayer in the garden. Not my will, but thine be done. That's part of this contrast of this greatest act of love. In fact, Jesus himself said, greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. We understand that today. I'd like to turn that verse around. See, we look at it just the way it's written. Greater love hath no man than this, and a man lay down his life for his friends. Let's look at the other side of this. I believe we could say, without doing injustice to this verse, greater hatred hath no man than this, that a man take the life of one who loves him. Greater hatred hath no man than that a man would reach out and kill someone who loves him. You see that sometimes in our world with as much sin and debauchery. You see someone maybe killing their mother or their grandma. Someone who loved them and tried to care for them. And society recoils from that because greater hatred hath no man than this. So here, as Jesus was being crucified, this moment of the greatest of love, this moment of condemnation and death, Jesus had the greatest love while man had the greatest hatred, and they didn't comprehend it. The people missed it. Number two, another contrast, is this. Calvary, the place of the fountain of grace, yet the fulfillment of the law. Place of the fountain of grace being opened up. We often think about grace and law being vastly different, and they are. But on Calvary's cross, the fountain of grace was opened up while it was the fulfillment of the law. John chapter 1 verse 17 says, the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. Romans 3:24, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Jesus Christ. The grace of Jesus Christ that flowed from that cross is our only hope of redemption. Now, one of the interesting things about this, one of the reasons the Jewish rulers were so mad at Jesus, one of the reasons they were fighting against this, one of the reasons they wanted to put Jesus to death was to preserve their religion. Their synagogues were being emptied out. People were not going to and offering sacrifices. People were following Jesus. And so the Jewish rulers thought they needed to preserve their religion, their sacrifices, the Mosaic law. And as they went about to kill Jesus, they actually fulfilled the Mosaic law and did away with their religion that they thought they were preserving, and they had no clue they were doing it. That's this Calvary being the fountain of grace, but the fulfillment of the law. It's a beautiful picture how that law and grace met on the cross. Law was fulfilled. The old covenant was fulfilled. And the new covenant was issued in. Hebrews talks about this. Hebrews 4:14. Seeing then that we have a great high priest that is passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feelings of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Calvary is the place of the fountain of grace, but the fulfillment of the law. I don't know what happened that day in the temple as the priests and high priests were preparing the Passover lambs. And that veil of the temple was torn from top to bottom. Those men knew that to look behind that curtain was immediate death. I can't help but believe that as that thing, it had to make a terrible noise as it ripped from top to bottom by the material that it was made of. It took a tremendous force, but it was easily possible with God. Just like rolling the stone away was possible. But as that veil was rent from top to bottom and those men couldn't help but look at what's happening, and they saw into the mercy seat and they didn't die. I don't know what happened in their hearts. I suppose their heart was pounding like ours does when we get scared. Maybe they tried to go put this thing back together. They didn't understand this great contrast that here on this day, the fountain of grace is opened up from behind that veil while fulfilling the law and putting away the first and ushering in the second. I think this morning that the law, the Old Testament sacrificial system and all those things that we have there help to define grace. As you look at the sacrifices for sin, as you look at the Old Covenant and what it took for covering sin from year to year, it provides a background that as we look at the grace that is in Jesus Christ today, we realize how precious it is. We realize what it means for us. In that it takes away that whole sacrificial system. I question this morning if we would fully understand the preciousness of the grace and provision of Jesus Christ if we didn't have the Old Testament leading up to it to provide a backdrop, to provide a defining of grace as we realize how much better the sacrifice of Jesus is than the sacrifice of bulls and of goats in the Old Covenant. The Old Covenant was not a mistake. God didn't do something wrong and then had to make it better. It was God's plan for the time being before ushering in the New Covenant. Number three, another contrast on Calvary. Calvary, the place where man did his worst, but God did his best. Man did his worst while God did his best. I want you to think about this. Because here on this crucifixion day, creation was crucifying their creator. Now, I build a little shed at my house. I am the builder. The shed is to serve me. It is mine. I have some things in mind for this shed. I have a plan. It is mine. I would not be happy if that shed would reach out and grab me by the neck and choke me. Now we know it can't do that. But you know how shocking that would be if something that I paid for, something that I made, something that I designed would rise up and destroy me. That's exactly what happened on the cross. Creation crucified their creator. And God stood still for it. It's no wonder it got dark. It's no wonder there was an earthquake. It's no wonder those things happened. Because creation was killing the creator. Man did their worst, while God did their best. God did his best. Go with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. And I want to show you what Paul says about this event. Paul tells us that these people who took Jesus to the cross didn't know what they were doing. If they had known what they were doing, they wouldn't have done it. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Let's see, verse 6. Howbeit we speak wisdom among them that are perfect, yet not the wisdom of this world, nor of the princes of this world that come to naught. But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, even the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the world unto our glory, which none of the princes of this world knew, for had they known it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. You see, Paul says the princes of this world didn't have a clue what they were doing. They thought they were destroying the plan of God, and they were helping to establish the plan of God. They thought they were in control and bringing an end, and they were in control of bringing a beginning. They were not in control, but God was in control of bringing a beginning, and God was using them. Man did his worst, but God did his best. You can go to the thought of them offering Pilate, offering Barabbas to be released. I think Pilate was struggling. He didn't want to go through with condemning Jesus to be crucified. He wrestled with that. His wife said, "Don't have anything to do with this just man. I've had dreams about this." And he wanted him released. And so he thought of a plan. He thought, surely if I would set the worst of criminals alongside of Jesus and say, "Look, at the feast I need to release one. And it's this man or this man." And I believe that Pilate thought that surely these people will look at it and say, "Well, that's obvious. Release Jesus. We can't release Barabbas." I think that's what Pilate was doing when he set up one of the worst of criminals with Jesus. But the people said, "Let Barabbas go free. Condemn a sinless one. We want the murderer free, released." Man did his worst, while God did his best. Matthew chapter 27. I'd just like to read a few verses there. Thinking about man and what they were doing. Matthew chapter 27. We'll start with verse 36. Jesus is hanging on the tree. Verse 35, they parted his garments, cast lots for his vesture. Verse 36, it says, and sitting down, they watched him there. How could people sit down that day just casually watching, gambling for his clothes? These people had no clue that the destiny of heaven and earth was hanging in the balance. The destiny of human souls and the salvation was being there determined that day. And they sit down gambling, watching, because they have no clue what this is about. Verse 37, they set up this accusation over his head. Jesus, the King of the Jews. Two thieves were crucified with him in verse 38. Verse 39, and they that passed by reviled him, wagging their heads and saying, "Thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save thyself. If thou be the Son of God, come down from the cross." See, they didn't know what Jesus meant by destroying the temple and building it in 3 days. He was talking about his body dying in the grave 3 days and being resurrected again. They had no clue. They used this against him and said, "If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross." Likewise also, the chief priests mocking with the scribes and elders said, "He saved others, himself he cannot save." They didn't realize that what they said was exactly true. If he was going to save others, he could not save himself from the cross. If he saved himself from the cross, he would not be able to save others. And they acted like, well, this is ridiculous. He thinks he can save others. He was among us working miracles, and now he can't save himself. They didn't realize that he was well able to, but because he loved so much, he stayed on the cross for you and I. If he be the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross and we will believe him. Do you think that would have happened? If Jesus would have stepped off the cross and said, okay, here I am. I delivered myself. Now believe on me. Do you think they would have knelt down and said, Jesus the Messiah, we worship you? No, I don't think so. I think they said that statement a little like sometimes we make statements kind of fast, that if thus and thus happens, then this. And really, it wouldn't be that way. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now if he will have him, for he said, I am the Son of God. The thieves cast the same into his teeth. Well, you have people there not having a clue what's going on the cross. You have Jesus hanging on the cross. You have this happening. He's watching it. He knows full well what's going on. He knows full well what this. He knows that man is out thinking they're destroying the work and plan of God, and God is establishing his plan for humanity. The very thing that they're mocking is the very thing that they need for eternal life. Another part of this contrast, thinking about man doing his worst and God doing his best. I had to think about what Isaiah said of Jesus as he prophesied his coming. He said, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. What Isaiah meant is the government. He shall reign forever and ever. But on this day, the government is putting him down. The government is on his shoulder, crucifying him. How can it be that the one who shall reign forever is in submission and subjection to a government that is putting him to death? And yet he's the one who will reign forever. That's a tremendous contrast on the cross. King of kings and Lord of lords being put to death by Roman authorities. He had authority over all, but on this day he was submitted and subjected to evil governments. Number four, another contrast that the cross is Calvary, the place where a lamb was slaughtered, but the lamb was in control. A lamb was slaughtered, but the lamb was in control. Isaiah 53, verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he openeth not his mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. Here a lamb was slaughtered, but the lamb was in control. I'd like to show you the control of the lamb on this day as he hung there dying. Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23, we should start with verse 39. This is the thieves relating to Jesus. Remember, this is a dying man. Remember, Jesus is being put to death. Remember, the Romans are trying to stamp out. They want to bring an end. They think they're bringing an end to this. And listen, verse 39, and one of the malefactors which were hanged railed on him, saying, if thou be Christ, save thyself and us. But the other answered, rebuked him, saying, dost thou not fear God, seeing thou art in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man hath done nothing amiss. Can you imagine Jewish rulers at the foot of the cross hearing a thief saying to the other thief? Now, he had to say it loud enough that they could hear it across, because one was on one side, the other on the other side. So there's a little bit of distance there. They weren't whispering. Had to be said loud enough that could be heard on the ground, I'm sure. And this one thief says to the other one, don't you fear God? Don't you see we're all dying? And don't you realize we are here because we've done wrong, but this man is innocent? What do you think the Jewish rulers, all I can see is a picture of them scowling. How dare an evil criminal say that? An innocent one. I think maybe that gave them some cause for concern. This thief said, this man hath done nothing amiss. And he said unto Jesus, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. What kingdom? What do you mean? This is an end to the kingdom. This is the last day of Jesus' kingdom and things on earth. They had the sign above his head, Jesus, the King of the Jews. And this was fit to be the end. And this thief says, remember me when you begin your kingdom. Can you imagine the scowl on the Jewish scribes and Pharisees' faces as somebody's talking about this man beginning a kingdom? This is a lamb dying, but a lamb that's in control while he is dying. And then Jesus looks at him and says, verily I say unto thee, today thou shalt be with me in paradise. A lamb dying, but a lamb's in control. He knows where he's going. He knows he's dying. And he's actually saving a sinner before he completed the sacrifice. Well, his blood was already running. His blood was already shed. But this is, you know, it seems to me that Jesus, this is a picture of God hardly being able to wait to put the blood of the New Testament in gear to save sinners, because there's one saved on the cross right while Jesus is dying. And that's the God that we serve, that wants all men to experience that blood. And here it is. This man's being saved at the last minute on the cross. This is a lamb dying, but a lamb is in control. This didn't spin out of control. The authorities thought it did. They thought he was in subjection to them. But the way this conversation is going on the cross, they didn't like it. Maybe this was the reason why later they set guards at the tomb and everything, because this really bothered them. This doesn't sound like it normally sounds when we crucify someone. And so here we have three men dying on the cross. One thief is dying in sin. The one that's railing is dying in sin. The other thief on the other side of Jesus is dying to sin. He found forgiveness. He's dying to sin. He's finding cleansing. Now what's Jesus doing? He's dying for sin. Listen, of all the people who have ever lived on the earth and will ever live on the earth, they can be divided in those three categories. All men who have ever walked the face of the earth will either die in sin or to sin. Only one man was able ever to die for sin, Jesus Christ. Those are the only three categories of people today. And you and I today have made the choice to die to sin. And we can make that choice because Jesus died for sin. If we ignore that, if we walk away from that, the only other option for us is to one day die in our sin. And I'm so glad this morning for the blood of Jesus that we do not have to think about that prospect of dying in sin, but we can go forward with faith in the blood of Christ, living for God today, enjoying that precious blood, so that we know that when our life is finished here, we're ready to go and hear those words, welcome into paradise by Jesus. Jesus was not a martyr. Jesus was a willing sacrifice. Here in chapter 23, verse 46, listen to Jesus. It says, and when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having said thus, he gave up the ghost. Jesus was in control of the very moment of his death. He came to this point and he said, here I come, Father. The Roman soldiers came to take control of the moment of death. They came to break their legs so they would die sooner, so they could be taken off the cross for the Sabbath. The Jews didn't want them hanging, the dead bodies hanging there. And so the Romans thought that they needed to control the moment of death. And when they got there, Jesus was already gone, because this is a lamb being slaughtered that is in control. He was not a martyr. He was a willing sacrifice. He gave himself. Ephesians 5:2 says, we are to walk in love as Christ also hath loved us and hath given himself for us an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet smelling savor. He's given himself. He was a willing sacrifice. Yes, it was difficult in the flesh for him. Yes, there was pain. Yes, he said, not my will, but thine be done. But he went to the cross. He bore all of that for you and I. Galatians says about Jesus, who gave himself for our sins, that he might deliver us from this present evil world, according to the will of God and our Father. So Calvary is a place where a lamb was slaughtered, but the lamb was in control. Number five, Calvary is a place that demands a response from every man. Place that demands a response, and the responses were vastly different on that day. Go back to Matthew chapter 27, and let's just notice a few of the responses and think about the contrasts that are there in the responses. Matthew chapter 27, verse 54. Here's a man, a centurion, a Roman, not a Jewish ruler, a Roman soldier. A centurion was responsible for 100 soldiers under him. Verse 54 of chapter 27 of Matthew. And now when the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus saw the earthquake and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, "Truly this was the Son of God." And so there's respect, there's belief. They said, "This was the Son of God." Many women were beholding afar off. Women who followed Jesus, but women who are staying back. I don't blame them. From this ugly event, caring enough to be close, but not able to be up that close, struggling to accept the death of Jesus, trying to perceive what it meant, loving him, and yet, what kind of cruelty were they observing? Verse 57, you have Joseph of Arimathea coming, a rich man. He goes to Pilate and he says, "Can I have the body of Jesus? I want to give him an honorable burial." And so Pilate gives it to him. He takes the body down and buries it. Well, but notice in verse 62, the next day that followed the day of the preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees came together unto Pilate, saying, "Sir, we remember. I think those memories were a little difficult for those men because they saw something that they never saw before. We remember that deceiver said, while he was yet alive, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' Command therefore that the sepulcher be made sure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away and say unto the people, 'He has risen from the dead.' So the last error shall be worse than the first." Pilate said unto them, "Ye have a watch, go your way, make it as sure as you can." I almost think I sense something in Pilate's voice is somewhat of mockery to the soldiers. "Here's your soldiers. Make it as sure as you can." The fact is, you can't make it very sure against the Son of God. And therein is another contrast. Roman soldiers with all their power and authority, having taken Jesus to the cross and killed him, there they stand at the tomb to keep him in the tomb, and all that power and vanished. And God didn't even have to work to get Jesus out of the tomb. He didn't have to sweat it and muster up a lot of energy. It was just like a puff of his breath, and away came Jesus. And the soldiers, with all their pomp and power, were nothing. So they went and made the sepulchre sure, sealing the stone and setting a watch. A sealed stone and a watch set will not hinder the power of God. These people are fighting against, and they know that if Jesus raises from the dead, they're in trouble. They know that. They've heard that much of the message, that if that happens, they'll have to admit he's the Son of God. They know that, and they want to keep that from happening. I don't believe they thought he would raise from the dead. I think they thought that the disciples would make up a story. But you know what? The disciples weren't there. They didn't make up a story. They didn't have anything to do with it. It was the power of God that brought forth Jesus. Well, if you go down to chapter 28, verse 11. "Now when they were going, behold, some of the watch came into the city and showed unto the chief priests all the things that were done. And when they were assembled with the elders and had taken counsel, they gave large money unto the soldiers, saying, 'Say ye, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we slept.'" Imagine Roman soldiers willing to say, "We were sleeping and his disciples won over us." They were willing to say that lie because they didn't want the other truth to be known. And so they were willing to do that. And the Roman rule would have been that they would have faced death for not keeping their trust. But the chief priest said, look, see in verse 14, and if this come to the governor's ears, we will persuade him and secure you. They had some work to do to tell the governor, listen, that's what it was. These disciples are really cunning men. Just don't kill the soldiers. They did their best. That's okay. The disciples got it. They were willing to make up this story. And it says, so they took the money in verse 15 and did as they were taught. And this saying is commonly reported among the Jews until this day. Well, verse 16, the 11 disciples were in Galilee and Jesus appointed them. When they saw him, they worshipped him. But some doubt it. This is the point that Calvary demands a response from every man. Some worship, some doubt. Some follow, some reject. Some mock, some bless. Calvary demands a response. There would be more contrasts we could have looked at. Jesus, the light of the world, hanging in 3 hours of darkness. We could look at Jesus, the water of life, saying, I thirst. We can look at Jesus, the Almighty One, not being even able to carry his cross. It's just so many contrasts. This morning, I wonder what contrast might be here today. Am I facing some hardship, some chastening? And I think it's pretty tough what I'm going through and what God has asked me to carry. While commemorating the greatest hardship of all, the death of Jesus Christ. I need to think about that contrast because it's easy for me to whine about my lot in life. I'm so thankful for what Jesus did for me this morning. Why can't I love and appreciate and willingly sacrifice the little bit that he's called me to sacrifice in the callings of life that he's called me to? Communion should remind us of our great debt to Jesus Christ and what little we have to give. It should remind us that our suffering is so minor compared to what Jesus has given. Is some other love stealing my heart this morning while I observe this ordinance of divine love? I believe this morning communion should deepen our love for our Savior. It should remind us of Jesus' great love for us. Do I struggle with some fear and some worry about the future? Is something making me uncomfortable? Something bothering me? Because the future looks dark. The future looks bleak. Communion should remind us of how God controls events even when they look bad to man. It should help us to remember that God uses bad things done by men to bring good things done by God. Did you catch that? That's what happened on the cross. Bad things done by men accomplished good things done by God. And only God is able to do that this morning. Only God is able to do that. So we've gathered this morning to commemorate this communion, this suffering and death of the Lord.